Hello, hello. Welcome to another episode of Your Talk. My name is Devin Readers, and today we have Lee Wind here with us. How are you?
Hi, Devin. I'm really happy to be here. Thanks.
First of all, tell us about yourself, and then we'll go from there.
Sure. I'm an author. I have three books out. They're all books for kids in different sort of age ranges. And the book I'm most excited that we're going to talk about is my nonfiction book for basically people age 11 and up. That's called No Way They Were Gay. I am also a blogger. I've been running a blog for about 15 years called I'm Here, I'm Queer, What the Hell Do I Read? And if you haven't gotten it yet from the description of what I do, I am gay, and I didn't come out until I was in my 20s. So a lot of what I do as an adult is trying to make our world a place where kids can be authentically themselves.
How was it coming out in your 20s, and what was that like?
I think coming out was a culmination of 14 very hard years of being closeted and really actively hiding every day who I was and just being a big actor. And I dated girls and I kept thinking that I judged that it was the right thing to do, but I didn't feel what I knew I was supposed to feel. I was pretty torn up about it. And my parents were immigrants and didn't react very well. And it took a very long time for us all to get kind of happy place. It did happen eventually. And I kind of got my own happily ever after. I've been with my husband almost 25 years and we have a grown daughter. Yeah, it's been quite the journey.
So when did you first realize you were gay, if you don't mind me asking?
No, not at all. I always felt a little different and excluded. And I think I wasn't able to pinpoint what it was. When I was 11 years old, I remember being with my family in New York City, and we had gone to down in the village, some ice cream store, and it was very much for the straight gaze, Gaze. And it was gaze on display for the straight gaze. And there was a young woman who was very beautiful, wearing like a leather bra and with a little whip by her side, and very much to titillate the tourists. And there was also a young man who was there wearing like torn jeans and like a leather harness. And I just thought he was the most beautiful thing I'd ever seen in my whole life and was gobsmacked and couldn't even talk and couldn't order my ice cream articulately. And then when we left, my whole family broke into like hysterical laughter. Basically, like we had just visited animals in the zoo. And it was really crushing. It was that moment that I knew that this beautiful experience that I finally understood what I wanted in the world. And I was 11. I wasn't going to start dating this 20 something guy, but just like that, I was able to both understand and in the same moment realize I had to hide. That was really hard. And I remember it as if it happened 10 minutes ago.
So I have to ask, what kind of ice cream shop is this? Like that they had whips and a guy in a
Yeah.
harness.
I think it was for tourists. I think it was like the gay village part of New York City. And it was like a hoot. I even remember there was like a neon rainbow in the window, but I didn't know anything about gay community or gay pride. And literally, I had no idea there was anybody gay in the world but me. And I think that's why it was such a shock when I was older and I'd come out. I went to a talk and this guy was talking about the letters that Abraham Lincoln wrote Joshua Price Speed that convinced him that Abraham was in love with Joshua. And I was like, how can that possibly be true? At this point, I was in my 30s and I was just like, I would have heard of this. And I went to the library and got out a book that the appendix had all the letters that Lincoln had written to Speed and was just history was always taught in a big way that it felt really boring to me in school. It was like names and dates to memorize, and I just couldn't have felt less connected to it. But so I just was skipping around, a little bored already, and I had landed on a letter. Abraham and Joshua had lived together for 4 years in Springfield, Illinois, and then Joshua left and moved back to Kentucky, where he was from, and married a woman named Fanny. And 8 months after that wedding, Abraham writes him a letter and says, Are you now in feeling as well as judgment, glad that you're married as you are? I know this is an impudent question not to be tolerated, but I know you'll tolerate it from me. Please tell me quickly, I feel very impatient to know. And we don't have the answer, but we do know it was less than 4 weeks later that Abraham married Mary Todd. And I read that letter, are you now in feeling as well as judgment? And that's exactly how I felt all those years dating girls. I judged it, I didn't feel it. I kept wondering, would the feeling come? And then I finally got honest. And in that moment, I got goosebumps and I was like, oh my gosh, maybe they were in love with each other. And that just spun my whole world topsy-turvy. And I thought, wait, if I have a reflection of myself in history, how amazing is that? And how empowering is that? And I thought, well, I don't have a time machine to go back and tell my 11-year-old, but I'm a writer and I can write a book for kids and try to let them know. So I started writing a novel, actually, which is my first book that came out, called Queer as a $5 Bill, and about a kid today growing up in a small town, a really homophobic small town in Oregon, a bit of a proxy for myself, gay, closeted, inadvertently dating his best friend who's a girl. And he stumbles on the same letter I did, gets the same goosebump moment, and decides he's going to out Abraham Lincoln online because everybody loves Abraham Lincoln, especially he lives in, you know, Lincolnville, Oregon, and his parents run the Lincoln Slept Here Bed and Breakfast. It's fiction. I made a lot of that up. But within the fictional story of the giant backlash, conservative firestorm that this character ignites was a lot of real history. And in fact, I got to publish it so that all the primary source stuff was in bold. There's a big endnote section where you can find all the quotes and all the history. And as I was writing the novel, just there was more and more evidence that kept coming up. But remember, I didn't like history very much. So I decided that maybe there was a nonfiction book, but maybe it was more than just Abraham and Joshua. Maybe it was something bigger, because I started to find out all these other stories about Mahatma Gandhi and his relationship, the love of his life. It wasn't his wife, Kasturba, which they were married when they were children, but it was this German Jewish architect, Hermann Kallenbach, and Eleanor Roosevelt. And yeah, she was married to FDR, but you know, she was also in love with this woman, Lorena Hickok, who was the first female reporter to get her byline in the front page of the New York Times. And just more and more things happened. And I realized, or I discovered more and more history, and also people that lived outside gender boundary. There was a pharaoh called Hatshepsut in Egypt who, over the course of 22 years of ruling Egypt, basically changed their public presentation of their gender completely. They were presenting as a woman, and then with an in-between phase. And then towards the end of their reign, they were presenting completely as a man. With a false beard and the crown, and was declared themselves king, not queen, but king of Egypt. So as I kept coming up with more and more stuff, I thought, maybe that's the nonfiction book I want to write. Maybe I want to write a book that kind of helps just take down the false facade of history as we're taught. And we're taught still in schools today that the most important people in history were these rich, white, straight, cisgender, able-bodied men from Europe. And it's just not true. There are so many stories of people of color and women and disabled people and men who love men and women who love women and people who love without regard to gender and people who live outside gender boundaries. So I couldn't do all of that. And I didn't feel like I had a place in telling the stories of women and people of color and disabled people. But I did feel like I am gay. I can tell the stories of the queer people in history that are really surprising. And so that's what I tried to do.
Yeah, I find it interesting. You said that. I find it interesting that we don't learn about the disability rights movement in school. Like everything I know about the disability rights movement is from my own research.
Exactly. Like, and we really need people in all of these communities to do the research, but then also write the books. Devin, where's your book? I want to read it.
That'll come after I graduate college in May. So tell me about your children's books and what made you want to write them.
Actually, all the books I have are children's books, but are books for kids or teens. I feel like being the G of LGBTQIA2+ makes me feel like my job is to be an ally to all those other letters, but also to other communities that aren't really getting their rights. So women, people of color, disabled people. And I'm constantly trying to figure out, like, how can I do more? How can I be a better ally? How can I take these words from the past, from these people in the past, and bring them forward? Because I think a lot of the problem is that history has been told by the people in power, and it's been told in such a way that it's sanitized out a lot of our stories. Just like I did in the novel, in the nonfiction book, No Way They Were Gay, I got the publisher to agree to put all the primary sources in bold. So you could really hear the voices of these different people. And then it just kept being more and more surprising. And actually it was interesting because one of the women who loved women that I have a chapter on in the book, it was Queen Anne, who was queen of England, Great Britain, the United Kingdom. And it was really interesting because she was disabled and she suffered from gout. And at one point she wasn't able to even climb the palace stairs. And even though Great Britain and France were at war, it turns out that Louis XIV, who was King of France, sent Anne, who was Queen of the UK, new invention that they called a wheelchair, which
that
she
is
loved.
Crazy.
Yeah, and in the 1700s. I thought that was fascinating. And I love that little like tie-in because there's so much intersectionality among our communities. And so like my hero that I feel like I learned about in working on this book was Bayard Rustin, who was openly gay, was really active in the civil rights movement. And in fact, was the guy that taught Martin Luther King Jr. about the whole functionality of nonviolent protest. And Bayard was the guy that organized the famous March on Washington in 1963, where Dr. King gave his famous I Have a Dream speech. So in the 1980s, Bayard was interviewed and was asked if he has advice for other Black gay activists. And this is what he said. And so I'm going to read just a little quote from the book. Well, I think the most important thing I have to say is that they should try to build coalitions of people for the elimination of all injustice. Because if we want to do away with the injustice to gays, it will not be done because we get rid of the injustice to gays. It will be done because we are forwarding the effort for the elimination of injustice to all. And we will win the rights for gays or Blacks or Hispanics or women, and I'll add, and disabled people within the context of whether we are fighting for all. And I feel like he could have said that yesterday, and I couldn't agree with it more. I really feel like we have to stand up together for each other.
Yeah, he could have said that 2 hours ago, and it would have been just as relevant, which is, I don't know whether that's sad or enlightening.
But it feels good to bring his voice out, right? Like so more people hear it. And I think that the fact that we still are struggling with this stuff, that's hard. And I think that I see it in the disabled community as well as in the queer community, that like language is so important. And I'm thinking about like homosexual and how that word isn't particularly helpful because it makes everybody that's not queer focus on the fact that, well, queer people have sex in a way that makes them uncomfortable. So if the word was homolovual, if we were focusing on love rather than sex, and like my family, my husband, my daughter, myself, the love that holds us together is the same love that holds everyone else's family together. If we were focusing on love, maybe we'd be having different cultural conversations. Maybe we wouldn't be fighting about talking about the existence of queer people in schools when we're talking about love rather than sex. Nobody's advocating having sex. Nobody's advocating teaching sex to children, but it's saying that somebody has two moms or two dads, or somebody's gender identity is outside the gender binary, that is completely appropriate for little kids. And I think we're in a weird place with it. And similarly, the language is so important in the disability community. I know how upset some of my friends get when people use language that minimizes, or I don't know, ableist language that you all find offensive. And I feel like it's really important that we talk about language.
And yeah, like I'm pretty much okay with any language that you use, but the two words that I get really offended by are retard and cripple. And I hate that even some of the people in the disability community use the word cripple to refer to themselves. And I know that it's trying to reclaim the word and debunk the stigma around it, but still, I'm like, there's some things we should just not say and leave there.
Yeah, language is so powerful, right? It's also, and I think growing up in art culture that is ableist and so homophobic, and add a bunch of other things to that too, but it makes us battle our internalized issues as well. Like I definitely feel like I still have internalized homophobia that occasionally rears up and surprises me. I'm like, really? I still feel that way?
Yeah, and I'm not saying that, we're not saying that everybody that's not disabled is ableist or everybody that's straight is homophobic. We're just saying that, like, up until now, we've had, it's starting to change, but we've had homophobic and ableist, like, ideals, I guess. You could say.
It's interesting. Like, I was listening to part of the research I was doing that's going to come for the next book. I was listening to an intersex activist give a TED talk, Nix Anunnaki Ray. And Anunnaki was saying that we talk about intersex people having gender dysphoria sometimes, or we talk about trans people having gender dysphoria. And he was saying that he wants to reframe it, or excuse me, they were saying that they want to reframe it as a cultural dysphoria. That the issue isn't the person who's outside the gender binary. The issue is that society only thinks people within the gender binary are valid. And so the dysphoria isn't really something that should be put on the individual. The dysphoria really is a problem of culture and of how we've structured our society.
Yeah, I'm doing a paper on the perception of rehab on social media. And one of the sources for it said something along the lines of, with stairs, for example, we see stairs as, oh, disabled bodies can't get up it. But what it actually is, oh, society doesn't accommodate disabled bodies. That's why we have stairs. And my mind was blown.
Yeah, I think that's really profound. It's, you don't think about how inaccessible things are if you're able-bodied, right? Like, I went to something, what talk once about diversity, and the presenter was talking about how hard it is to recognize that the world is set up for right-handed people if you're right-handed. But if you're left-handed people and you ask for a pair of scissors, you'll instantly know that the world is not set up for left-handed people. So sometimes we need to have it pointed out to us.
Yeah, and it's crazy. What would you say is, like, the biggest kind of misconception, I would say, about teaching kids about sexuality and stuff? And we're aware that, like, teachers, some crazy teachers out there have taught totally inappropriate stuff to kids, and that should not happen, but, like, we can't legislate the 99% of teachers for the 1% that would do that.
Yeah, and I really don't know that. I don't know. I haven't been in those classrooms where teachers are being inappropriate, but I would say that if we focus on identity and on sort of attraction, like people being romantically or physically attracted to someone else, like, that knowledge in itself is not age inappropriate. There's the most banned books list includes books like basically with about two male penguins falling in love and having a nest and getting an egg that was being abandoned by otherwise, and raising a little baby penguin chick in the New York City Central Park Zoo. And it's based on a true story. And that was like on the most banned books list for almost a decade. And there's nothing age inappropriate about that. It's this really sweet story about a two dad family that are penguin. There's a misconception that if they can prevent their children from knowing that there are queer people, then maybe their child won't be queer. But I can tell you that I grew up not knowing that there were queer people, and it just made me feel incredibly isolated and alone. And the statistics on self-harm are really shocking when it comes to queer kids. And I think we can do better. I think I just kept getting surprised when I was doing the research. So, like, one of the big surprises was that 1.7% of people are born with intersex traits, which is pretty much the same number of people that are born with red hair. And I had no idea that it was so common, but we've done things in our culture to, for a long time, to, without the consent of the baby, to basically just have them reassigned, have that child assigned one or the other of the two binary sexes that we thought were correct. And we've eliminated this third category of people. And I think that's shocking and horrifying. And I think it's really important for intersex people that are, you know, being activists today and are fighting still for hospitals to stop doing this unnecessary surgeries on babies and let the kids grow up and then make their own decision if they want to change their bodies or not. I think that was really shocking to me. And then also, I feel like as I was doing the research, I just kept thinking, wow, what interesting footnotes in history, like that these famous people were queer. But then I was reading the letters that Gandhi, Hermann Kallenbach, and at one point...
Who is Hermann Kallenbach? I'm sorry.
Ah, so Hermann Kallenbach was this German Jewish architect that was pretty much the love of Gandhi's life. And he helped Gandhi with a lot of the protests. They met when they were in South Africa. And it was so interesting because after reading the more than 200 letters between them back and forth, I started to get the sense that maybe it was more important. Maybe it was more pivotal to Gandhi's insights and evolution. Gandhi famously said, there are, hold on, I want to find the actual quote because that's what my book is about. It's about sharing the actual quotes. But he said that sorry, give me a sec. Trying to find the quote. Okay. You worship a being, a single entity as Allah, and another adores him as Khuda. I worship him as Ishwar. How does anyone stand to lose? You worship facing one way and I worship facing the other. Why should I become your enemy for that reason? We all belong to the human race. We all wear the same skin. We hail from the same land. When the facts are as simple as that, it will be nothing but folly and short-sightedness to bear implacable enmity towards one another. That was a huge breakthrough moment in sort of the evolution of humanity to say that, okay, we're all praying to the same God. And I think that it's not incidental that the love of Gandhi's life was this Jewish guy. And then I started to look at other relationships like Eleanor Roosevelt and Lorena Hickok that I mentioned earlier. And, you know, is it coincidence that Eleanor Roosevelt was in love with this other woman and had this decades-long relationship with her? And when she was no longer first lady, she went to the UN and was appointed as a special ambassador and really led the charge for the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Like, maybe these people being queer gave them insights that helped them make our world even more amazing and more special. And that was really exciting for me. That's when it all opened up like a flower and I got really excited because we start discovering all this history that is our legacy, like Sappho. So Sappho was really famous for being this poet who wrote about her love for other women. Because of that, there were centuries of trying to destroy evidence of her work, but some of it has survived, including one poem that where she talks about what's the most beautiful, powerful thing in the earth. And in that poem, she has this realization. She says, okay, there are those who say an array of horsemen and others of marching men and others of ships is the most beautiful thing on the dark earth, but I say it is whatever one loves. Talks a little bit about the Trojan War, and then she comes back and she says, now far away Anactoria comes to my mind, for I would rather watch her moving in her lovely way and see her face flashing radiant than all the force of Lydian chariots and their infantry in full display of arms. So this was a really big deal because before Sappho, all the famous poets, who were all men, said that the most beautiful, the most important, the most powerful thing in the world was an army or a battalion of ships or charging infantry, like a cavalry, like signs of like toxic masculinity, right? Like a power, male masculine power was the most important thing on the dark earth. And Sappho was like, no, the most beautiful thing on the dark earth is the face of the woman I love. And there was something about that resonated in people's hearts and became something that we really, that transformed our culture. And if you look back 800 years, like when they were writing in France, when they were writing Sleeping Beauty, and they needed something to break, it ended up being the kiss of true love. And all these Disney movies today that end with a kiss of true love and all these other, like that, we all collectively believe in our culture that love is the most powerful thing in the universe. We believe it because of Sappho and that she loved this other woman. And I think that's really exciting. And suddenly it's like history is full of things to discover, including our histories.
That is awesome. So what was the most surprising, like, LGBTQ plus figure that you learned about?
Oh, I was really surprised about Shakespeare. I just had no idea that I had to learn Shakespeare in school, Romeo and Juliet, and just all the regular things. But it turns out that there are over 120 love sonnets that William Shakespeare wrote to another. And a lot of them are like the label says, they're love sonnets to this other man. And he really openly in his sonnets talks about his love for this man and for this woman. And he's pretty much talking about being bi. And a lot of historians hid this for over 100 years. There was a version of his sonnets where they changed all the pronouns to make it seem like he'd written all of them to a woman. They took lines like, what's new to speak, what new to register that may express my love or thy dear merit? Nothing in versions that for 150 years were the only ones that were out there. Sweet boy became sweet love. The fact that like he was willing to talk about his life in these sonnets, and there are definitely historians that don't believe they're autobiographical, but I read them and I think it totally sounds like sonnet 144 starts, two loves I have of comfort and despair, which like two spirits do suggest me still. The better angel is a man fair, the worser spirit a woman colored ill. Like, that blows my mind that you can go to the Riverside Shakespeare, which is like this 1,000-page book about all of Shakespeare's stuff. And in it, it was published in the 1970s. There's the editor that compiled it was saying how important it was that they restored the pronouns to their proper sense. But we shouldn't misinterpret the flowery love language of when Shakespeare wrote these for the 1970s version of homosexuality. And I just read that and I got so angry because it seems like it's just pretending and lying to people. So I really wanted to put the words of these people from the past front and center and let kids decide, let readers decide for themselves. I'm not going to try to convince everyone that I'm right and they're wrong about history, but I do want to present it and put it out there and I'll share how I feel and then other people can make their own decisions, but I think it's incredibly empowering.
So I have to ask, was Mozart gay?
I don't know. I don't know about Mozart. I do know about Tchaikovsky and his being gay. And what's so interesting is that even though it's so incredibly well documented that Tchaikovsky was gay, I don't know about Mozart. I hadn't heard that one. So we'll have to look into it.
All I'm going to say is you have to watch the movie Amadeus and no, right. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart.
He's wasn't called the guy he was obsessed with. Yeah. But the guy he was obsessed with, wasn't it Salieri or something?
Yes. Yeah. So you have to decide for yourself if he's gay. I think he is. But is there anything else you'd like to add before we get to our final question?
I'll just say that there was one other person in history that I really wanted to do in the introduction, is talking about how a lot of times our stories haven't been respected. And there was this one person in history whose nickname was One-Eyed Charlie. And One-Eyed Charlie was a stagecoach driver during the California Gold Rush and famously defended the stagecoach from somebody trying to rob it by shooting them, and was the voted in one of the really early elections in California. And when One-Eyed Charlie passed away, friends discovered that the body that they thought was going to be a male was not. And it came out that Charlie was born Charlotte and had run away from Boston. And so after Charlie's death, it became a big thing that, oh, Charlie was the first woman to vote in a US presidential election. And on their tombstone, they did use the name Charlie and not Charlotte, but it does say that on the memorial, first woman to vote in the US, November 3, 1868. And I just thought that was really poignant and sad, kind of, because I don't think that's how, one, I Charlie lived their entire life as a man. So for retroactively to go back and negate that felt really sad and wrong. So I was happy that I could at least put that out there, that like we should try to respect people. If they've lived their entire life as a man, maybe they wouldn't want memorialized for being the first woman to vote in the US. So yeah. Anyway,
that is very interesting and sad and poignant.
Can I just chime in and say that I actually don't know if when you come about like those nicknames, like One Eye Charlie, that's a disability that they got a horse kick to the face when they were still back in Boston. And I thought, I was thinking about telling that story. And then I thought, I hope that's not offensive to your audience or to you.
Oh, no, but trust me, it's so hard to offend me. So when it comes to that stuff, I've had one of my parents' former friends who we don't talk to anymore. She said, why didn't you put her in a group home when she turned 18? So I've had way worse than that.
But I find it interesting that the disability became the nickname rather than, because they were lauded for many other things. But yeah, I don't know. A different time, I would hope that somebody wouldn't get that nickname today.
No, I would hope. One has to wonder these days, but I would hope. So are you ready for our final questions?
Absolutely.
So the first one is, my favorite TV show on earth is Survivor. So do you watch Survivor?
I haven't seen it lately, but I did watch it a while back. So I don't know what they're up to, the 38th season or something?
42. So.
Oh my goodness.
Second question, fill in the blank.
Conclusion is celebrating our differences and not just tolerating them.
And third and final question, what had you hopeful?
What has me hopeful? Conversations like this, where we can connect and share and learn. And I think that as we spread the word about cool things and insights and how we see things similarly and differently, I think that kind of dialogue will bend that arc of justice of history like a rainbow in the direction that we're hoping to move us all forward. Well, so thank you for this opportunity.
Thank you so much for being here. You were awesome. And we will see you guys next episode. Bye, guys.